Well, good morning, you hearty few, brave souls, coming through the winter weather to get here. It seems like for several years now I've made something of a tradition of talking about joy the week before Christmas. And you can imagine why. You know, there's always a kind of irony to joy to the world ringing from loudspeakers, shopping malls, and everywhere. When for so many people, the holiday season is not very joyous. We've come through weeks of short, dark days. Particularly rainy until recently. And that's hard for a lot of people. It's a time when loneliness can feel more acute. It's a time when family tensions and estrangements feel more painful. And it's a time when the state of the world can seem more dire than this past year. There are many reasons to feel that way about the state of the world. As you all know. So it's a time when we need to make special effort to cultivate joy in our lives. And of course there are special joys of the season and spending time with family and friends, but that's not always the case for everybody. Buddhism has been accused of being kind of stern and joyless by those who enter into comparative religion classes sometimes. Buddhism is seen as focusing on suffering, which of course it does. Dukkha. Of course, the Buddha taught that human life is marked by suffering, dukkha, impermanence, and non-self, or non-separate self, you know, no self existing except in relationship to all other phenomena. Those are called the three marks of existence. But the Buddha never denied that there's also sukha, or happiness and ease. In the world, in our lives. I looked up the etymology of these two words, dukkha and sukha. And it turns out that du and su are, in Sanskrit, probably Pali as well, are prefixes meaning bad and good. And ka means an empty space, or originally a hole, and particularly the hole that the axle goes through in a cartwheel, right? So dukkha means a bad axle hole, and sukha means a good axle hole. And so you can imagine, you know, a cart with a bad axle hole would be pretty uncomfortable to ride in because it would be pretty rough going, and a cart with a good axle hole would be very, you know, a pretty nice smooth ride, minimizing the bumps. So I thought that was pretty descriptive of the rough edges of our karmic lives, you know. The way dukkha and sukha, the way we experience them. So sukha, ease, happiness, joy. What does that really mean in the context of our practice? A couple of weeks ago, a number of us met here for the first of what's going to be a series of meetings to put together a kind of long-term vision and mission and plan for Mountain Rain. We usually kind of just meet and say, okay, what would we like to do next year? And this is, we're going to try and get a little longer view. And with some helpful facilitation by Anne Svensson, we brainstormed on the wall a bunch of phrases and words that came to us to express our vision. And some of the verbs that came up were fostering, cultivating, opening to. Those were the main verbs. And some of the nouns, the main nouns that appeared on this brainstorming map were freedom, happiness, wisdom, compassion, community, world. But we kind of ran into trouble when we considered what those words would mean to someone with no Dharma context to understand them. You could say the essential goal of Buddhist practice is freedom from suffering. Pretty simple. That's what the Buddha taught, right? Four Noble Truths. But someone said, but people don't want to hear about suffering. So we can't say that. You know, ooh, suffering? No. But if we just say freedom, the conventional meaning of freedom in our society is freedom to do whatever you want, or freedom from responsibility, freedom or obligation. So freedom to or freedom from. We don't really have a concept of freedom that goes beyond freedom to and freedom from. Then what about happiness? We usually associate happiness with getting what we want in life, right? Opening the wrapping of that Christmas present and getting this is just what I wanted, right? That's our conventional idea of happiness. But it's not the happiness the Buddha had in mind. And then there's wisdom and there's compassion, the two qualities we cultivate on the Bodhisattva path to free ourselves and others from suffering. But wisdom doesn't necessarily appear in the image we most expect of it. You know, sometimes someone might appear to be a very wise person, and then they turn out to have significant blind spots, and we're disappointed, or even feel betrayed. Sometimes wisdom is expressed in ways that are quiet and not so visible. And even compassion can have a bad rap in our culture, right? Compassion sometimes is seen as, you know, it's for wimps. It lets the bad guys off the hook. Where's the justice in that? Compassion and justice can, in our culture, often are seen as in opposition. So we run smack up against the limits of words. No wonder those old Zen masters in the koans like to subvert language, you know? But as we practice and study the Dharma through being present to our own experience, we do come to have a deeper appreciation of these words. We come to appreciate these words in the context of our practice. So what about joy? Is it, you know, a superficial kind of Christmas carol feeling, or is there something more? The Buddha taught that joy is one of the Brahma Viharas, or heavenly abodes, known in Tibetan Buddhism as the Four Immeasurables, because they are limitless practices, and they are metta, or loving kindness, karuna, compassion, upekkha, equanimity, and mudita, joy. And the word mudita is also translated as gladness. And it's often interpreted as primarily sympathetic or empathetic joy. So gladness in the happiness and well-being of others. So it's not a self focused feeling. And it's considered to be particularly important to cultivate in balancing compassion. When our compassion becomes heavy and overwhelming, we're overwhelmed by the suffering around us and in the world, then we need to cultivate joy. We need to cultivate mudita. So in the traditional practice of mudita, the focus, as I said, is on the happiness of others. So we begin typically by calling to mind a dear friend, someone who's in whose happiness we can easily feel gladness. And then, and you use a phrase, something like, may your happiness and good fortune continue. That's sort of a classic phrase. And then you choose a benefactor, someone who's been beneficial in your life. And then a neutral person, and then a difficult person. Right? Feeling gladness in the well-being of that difficult person. Now that can be a little tricky, because sometimes that difficult person may take pleasure in something that we don't feel is so wholesome. So are we supposed to feel glad about that? I don't think so. I think when we do that practice, we look for whatever seed of wholesome well-being is in that person, and we feel a gladness about that. We cultivate an appreciation and gladness about that. Sharon Salzberg is a Vipassana teacher I'm sure you've heard of, who has written about and taught the Brahmaviharas for decades. She's the kind of go-to girl for metta and the Brahmaviharas. And she feels that joy is the hardest one to practice, because there are so many obstacles that get in the way of fully feeling and expressing joy. So I'm just going to give you some of her list. First one, top of the list, is judgment, right? We want people and things to be the way we want them to be. You know, we're always judging. And that gets in the way. Related is comparing mind. We're always judging whether we and what we identify with are better or worse or just as good as something or someone else. You know, the mind is a very strong habit. And of course, the Buddha taught that those comparisons are all varieties of conceit or self-clinging. Even if we think we're, you know, if our habit pattern is to think we're not as good as, that's still self-clinging, right? Or even, I'm just as good as, that's still self-clinging. Still self-focused. So you can see how comparing mind prevents you from feeling joy at the happiness and success of others. Mm. So that leads to the next obstacle, which is envy. Envy comes from a core feeling of deprivation, of not enough. You know. And so we envy the person we think has that thing we don't. And envy can be pretty consuming and debilitating when we're really in the grip of it. It's kind of a hungry ghost realm. That not enough place. So for some people, that leads to a habit of demeaning others, putting others down, in order to not feel that place of deprivation in oneself. Or, as I said, habitually demeaning oneself. Either way, it makes joy in others' happiness almost impossible. Another one on the list is avarice. It's not a word that comes up very often, but avarice is holding on to what we have, withholding, possessiveness. And again, underneath that is that mind of deprivation. These are all kind of related. What one more that she lists is prejudice, and that's so strong in our world today, of shutting others out of our heart because they're the other, right? In some way, they're the other, different from me and mine. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow once said, and I really always love this quote, "If we could read the secret histories of our enemies, we should find in each one's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility." If we could read the secret histories of our enemies, we should find in each one's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility. So I think when we do the practice, these heart practices with the Brahma Viharas, it's a practice of disarming hostility without even knowing the secret histories of our enemies. You know, we might not know, but we can trust and know that causes and conditions led to the suffering that has caused harm to us and to others. One more obstacle that we might not think of is boredom or apathy. Boredom or apathy, they're kind of fundamentally in the category of aversion, right? There's a turning away from experience as it is, saying, this is boring. This is not interesting enough. I don't care about this enough. Yeah, so it's an aversive state. But when we turn away from all those small annoyances of life, we also turn away from the many, many small sources of gladness, because we're turning away, we're shutting our hearts, we're closing our hearts. And when we're really, truly open to the vividness of the moment, our own happiness and the happiness of others aren't so separate. Yeah. We smile at others' well-being, just the way, you know how you smile when you see a little child absorbed in play. It just, immediately there's a feeling of connection and happiness arises. It's more like that. So when those obstacles, fear, aversion, envy, those states that cloud our naturally clear mind, when those hindrances drop away, we open to connection with what's around us. And that's a kind of joy. I was struggling, so how would I describe joy? And I think it's connection. It's what we feel when the obstacles drop away. The Buddha taught this joy, and it's a different word, it's called piti in Pali, as one of the seven factors of enlightenment. It's often translated as rapture. And that can sound very, you know, rapture, kind of like this, altered state. But it's the feeling that pervades body, heart, and mind when deeply, in deep meditation, deep stillness, that this word refers to. But it also can extend to a kind of joy or a lightness and openness in daily life, in living in the world. A kind of expanded perspective that allows us to enter into the moment with a kind of vivid interest. Whether that moment is conventionally pleasant or even sometimes painful, whether it's exciting or boring, whatever it is, entering in with lightness and openness. Those of us who've at times come close to someone who's dying, have sometimes felt that. You know, just being vividly present with that person in that experience, when the fear and the grief drop away. quiet joy enough, even in what conventionally would be seen as a really painful time. So it's this kind of joy that's so easy to miss in our frantic dance with the eight worldly dharmas: pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. We're always pursuing and avoiding, pursuing and avoiding. But there are those times when we stop. We listen, we look, senses open, heart open, minds open, and a kind of simple, quiet joy arises. We can cultivate this. We have to, actually, cultivate this deliberately. We can teach ourselves joy, as the novelist Barbara Kingsolver describes. I'm sure some of you have read her. She says, every one of us is called on, probably many times, to start a new life. A frightening diagnosis, a marriage, a move, loss of a job or a limb or a loved one, a graduation, bringing a new baby home. In my own worst seasons, I've come back from the colorless world of despair by forcing myself to look hard for a long time at a single glorious thing, a flame of red geranium outside my bedroom window, and then another, my daughter in a yellow dress, and another, the perfect outline of a full dark sphere behind the crescent moon, until I learned to be in love with my life again, like a stroke victim retraining new parts of the brain to grasp lost skills. I have taught myself joy over and over again. So as she says, we have to stop and be still long enough to attend to the details of our experience, to really be present with all our heart, mind, and senses. And then maybe we take some time to take note of them. Maybe we write a haiku. Haiku express those moments of aliveness. They're like little praise poems. Even if it's a kind of uncomfortable experience that's being described, making something of it, creating something, this little poem makes it a praise poem. And you might share that. Or if you're more visual, you might make a sketch, right, or something else. Or you might just share that moment with a friend at the time or later. These moments of joy are small gifts that we can receive and pass on with no fancy wrapping paper, no price tag, no receipt attached to return within 2 weeks if it doesn't fit. So I thought what we could do this morning is take a moment to just summon up a moment, maybe some from this past week. A moment of quiet joy. Just sit quietly for a moment and see what comes. And it may be that one comes easily, and it may be that that it's been a really hard week, and if there isn't one that comes, summon one up from a time in your life. You know, one of those touchstone joys. Okay. I'm going to give you a little one from my drive home last night from Vancouver. I had to work unexpectedly yesterday, so I took Michael to the Tsawwassen Ferry first, because he's going to spend a week in Vicky's cabin on Main Island doing a solo retreat. So I dropped him off, and then I drove back into town and worked for the day, and then I drove home, and this is my... And I really didn't really want to work yesterday, but someone else was really sick, and so I did. So here's my little double haiku that I wrote. River of crows crossing over Highway 1, headlights flow west, taillights east. In winter twilight, heading home to roost, I love crows and commuters equally. So I'm going to invite you to make a gift of a little piece of joy. We'll go around the circle to the person next to you. And this is based on the Japanese poet Ryokan, who after a thief broke into his little hermit's hut and took his robe or his mattress or something, I forget exactly. He went to the window and looked out and saw the beautiful full moon and said, "Oh, I would wish I could give him this full moon." Yeah. So we can give people things that, things that aren't so tangible. So if somebody would start and then to turn to the person to your left and say, "I give you," and then say what it is, and then we'll just keep going around. Okay, and it's okay if I leave the recorder on? No. I hesitate. Okay, so anyone listening to this, whoever listens, please do this little practice and give a joy to someone near you.